That's a great hymn reminding us of the value of the heritage of the saints and of knowing those who've gone before us. One of the texts that gives us a biblical basis for remembering specifically certain ones who have gone before us is Hebrews 13:7. Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. My goal for us this morning is to consider the way of life of Charles Bray Williams so that we may imitate his faith. It is a good and right thing for us to recognize the grace of God in others. Some may fear at times that this is detracting from the centrality of the glory of God, but we are not Gnostics. We believe that the glory of God is shown to us in his word, in the gospel, and that in the transformation of the lives of specific individuals. And so it is a joy to consider what God did in the life of Charles Bray Williams. You have some of the information about him in your worship guide, as well as then some things that will show up on the screen behind me along the way. But let me first also say a thanks to a number of people who helped bring this together in a number of ways. One is Dr. Poe, who's not here with us today. He's out of town. He doesn't know I'm going to talk about him. I didn't want to tell him. But he is the one who really set me on this track maybe 8 years ago, first mentioning the heritage of Charles Williams. And so I appreciate that. And then Steve Baker and Dr. Dockery and Cindy Meredith were helpful in finding a number of sources. David Wickizer helped me track down a number of things. And then especially Brian Dinker finding a number of items, particularly from the old Cardinal and Cream editions. So let's consider Charles Williams. You have his dates there, 1869 all the way to 1952. And then, before I really set him up, you can notice, if you can read this, a few of the positions that he held, just seeing who this man was in general before we walk through his life, holding a number of very important positions in the life of Southern Baptists and the broader evangelical world at the time. There at Southwestern Seminary, and then Howard College, which is now Samford, Mercer, and then here at Union. He was born on January 15th in 1869 near the small country village of Shiloh in North Carolina. And so there's the picture of the homestead. And this means we've just passed his 140th birthday. Now, I know that sometimes thinking about the past, it all kind of goes together. So I want to think about what this time was a little bit. This is 3.5 years after the close of the Civil War. So as he grows up, the men he would know would all have been veterans of the Civil War. And yet, he lives to well after World War II. This is a remarkable time. Some of the men in the Civil War are using muskets, and this is where he's growing up. By the time he dies, the atomic bomb has been developed. He lives through the time when the Wright brothers first make their flight at Kitty Hawk. And then by the time his life is over, air flight is somewhat common, particularly used in the military. A remarkable time and a remarkable man in the midst of this time. He grew up on a farm as one of six children, and apparently he mentioned often a relation to other famous Williams. And from what I have seen, it cannot be confirmed of these, but he mentioned being related to Roger Williams, the father of religious liberty in America, famous Baptist as well, to William Williams, signer of the Declaration of Independence, to Sir George Williams, founder of the YMCA, and William Williams, the author of Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. He obviously grew up in a devout family. He dedicated his book, Introduction to New Testament Literature, to his mother, writing, "Affectionately dedicated to my mother, who taught me to love the New Testament." A reminder there again of the value of early home life. Then, in the information largely gathered from the biography written by his daughter, Miss Charlotte Sprawls, who was mentioned earlier, he recalled to a number of people along the way his habit of reading and studying Latin with his book tied to the handles of his plow as a boy and young teenager. I think in Dr. Williams' life, there are a number of reminders to diligence and study, and this is one of them. He was living in the hard times in the South after the Civil War, and so as a boy, he had to work every day and wasn't able to go to school. While some would celebrate that, he didn't. So he studied at night and made the most of the times when his team, and I don't know if that was oxen or what they were, but when his team would pause in plowing, he would use that time to study. So that at the end of the week, he can meet with the teacher of the public school on Friday afternoons and recite the week's lesson so that he could get credit and finish school. And then he was so earnest in this, he actually finished school early so that by age 15, he was teaching in the country school and earning money then to pay off the debt on the family homestead. He is an example to us of diligence and hard work in our studies. Perhaps we should instigate a plowing field, Dr. Dockery, for Greek students today. But at age 17 then, he was licensed to preach and held several revivals at country churches in that area. Then he moved on to Wake Forest, where he worked his way through school with odd jobs and a pastorate, having been ordained while he was there at Wake Forest. Then he graduated in 1891 as valedictorian of his class with a GPA of 98.5, a mark that was not surpassed for 40 years. It was at Wake Forest that he first encountered Greek. It was also in college that I first had my encounter with Greek. It was life-changing to see the value and the pleasure of this, and all my Greek students agree. But he reflected, well, they especially do because we have class later today, so, but later in life, he reflected on learning Greek, and he mentioned this. He said, "It was easy as handsprings because I knew my Latin so well." There is also instruction there. Interestingly, they also here, even though I'm sure he was not aware of it, in this time at Wake Forest, he was following in the steps of another Southern Baptist giant, A.T. Robertson, who had been at Wake Forest just 6 years before, also graduated as valedictorian, and went on to work in the realm of Greek and New Testament. Also, Robertson, grown up in North Carolina in a poor situation, scraping by to get their education. These men of the past would remind us of the value of the educational opportunities that we have. After graduating from here, he was for 5 years pastor at Winton Baptist Church in the area, also serving as principal of their school. And it was during this time that he met and married, well, I'm sorry, there's the Wake Forest picture. This is a piece of the story was not known till today. That's actually his Wake Forest picture. And then there is the picture of him and his wife, Miss Alice. They'll be glad for me to correct that. Let's see where else I am. After that, in 1897, they moved to Pennsylvania to attend Crozer Theological Seminary. And as I looked at that name, I didn't know it. I imagine a number of us, this name of a seminary doesn't ring many bells, is now combined with another school in another location. But about the same time, Emmy Dodd, another significant Union graduate, was at Crozer Seminary. And I also discovered that James M. Pendleton, the second president of Union, when he was writing his book, Christian Doctrines, he dedicated that book to, really to Mr. Crozer, who endowed this seminary, and to his widow at that time. And here he's specialized in Greek and Hebrew. So here we have a New Testament scholar keeping up with his Hebrew. He graduated in 1900, pastoring local churches while he was there, and then published his thesis the following year, which was entitled Evolution and God, the History of Baptists in North Carolina. So also a biblical scholar with an interest in history, local history of his own churches. When he finished there, he was headed for Texas, but he stopped over in Arkansas, served as a principal of a high school there for a year, then made it to Texas, and from 1901 to 1905, he pastored churches in the Texas area and became a popular revival preacher. And in that role, I believe as a revival preacher and people hearing his name, he came to the attention of B.H. Carroll, one of the giants in SBC life at that time. In 1905, Carroll, who was then dean of the Theological School of Baylor, contacted Williams, interviewed him, and then hired him as chair of Greek, New Testament, and interpretation for Baylor, and then subsequently into Southwestern. When Southwestern launched as an independent school from Baylor, then Charles Williams was the founding professor of Greek and New Testament for Southwestern. Here's a picture of them on their way in that direction. It's the family. Can't see a whole lot of it, I know. And then there's the official portrait from Southwestern. He then served there from 1905 to 1919. He taught Greek, New Testament theology, biblical introduction, and pastoral theology, a good breadth there. Also in this time, he serves as the school's first librarian, as their financial agent for 8 years, which I'm sure means the one raising funds, which would have been quite a challenge. The managing editor of Southwestern Journal of Theology for a number of years, and eventually was the second dean at this school. While he was here, early on in Southwestern, he began to attend summer schools at the University of Chicago, earning in 1907 an MA in New Testament, and in 1908 the PhD in New Testament. And this is interesting for at least two reasons. One is that PhDs were not very common at this time. In fact, from what I can tell, Charles Williams may have been the only one of the founding members of Southwestern or Southern Seminary to have a PhD. That's not a slight on the other men at that time. PhDs were really just becoming popular. Otherwise, it was considered that you earned a doctorate by your work after being out of school, and that would be granted by some school or university. But this is interesting, then, that this PhD is not required at this time for him professionally. He has his job. He need not do this as far as keeping his place or his position. Nonetheless, he did. In this and a number of places, you find Charles Williams being a driven, hardworking man, interested to learn and to know. There's much effort given here, as there was with the plowing as a boy. But also, this study at this time would have been quite demanding. With all the other jobs he was doing, a full teaching load, at this time now a young family, two children. And from the records I've discovered, or not discovered, but I could find and look at, they made this trip by car. That's a 2,000-mile round trip each summer. That's a long trip for us today. With nice interstate systems and nice cars and everything else, I can only imagine what the roads would have been like in the early 1900s. What sort of back roads they would be on and what that would be like. And then also the cars. This photo actually is a couple decades later. But this would be something like what they were driving in from Fort Worth to Chicago and back each time in order to get this. As I told somebody, this is a time in which when you say Lincoln, they think Abraham, not town car. So the effort, the work, we have to pause for some. Simply to accomplish this, we find in Williams again an example of real diligence, hard work, commitment to excellence. While he was at Baylor before they broke off to be Southwestern, he was offered the pastorate of First Baptist Church Waco at a salary almost three times what he was making at Baylor. After the seminary moved to Fort Worth, he was offered the pastorates of Broadway Baptist Church and First Baptist Wichita Falls, again at salaries about three times what he was making. He declined each of these to continue his labors at the seminary. And this is not showing a lack of interest in pastoral ministry, since he continued to pastor in small churches all the way through his ministry. But it shows his commitment to the task at hand. And it shows that he was not guided in his life simply by a desire for money. Exemplary for us again. He continued to preach in various places and evangelistic meetings. This, I know you can't read the wording there, but it refers to a series of meetings. When World War I broke out and soldiers were gathering at camps to be sent out, a number of churches would send people to preach the gospel to these young men before they would go away. Dr. Williams was involved in this. And one area newspaper reported on one of the times when he was there to speak, and this is what they wrote, a secular paper. Dr. C.B. Williams of the seminary preached to a large crowd of soldiers in the First Baptist tent at Camp Bowie last Sunday night. Several of our members were present. The unanimous report is that Dr. Williams is one of a very few men who can hold the soldiers. They are hard to preach to. He had 75 professions. It is not usually expected that a seminary professor knows much about practical preaching, and it is refreshing to find a man of Dr. Williams' type who has a passion for lost souls and the gift of presenting a message in a live, red-hot manner. Soldiers on every hand expressed a desire for him to return, and we hope that he may do so. Again, another example of high commitment to academics, but also the ability to communicate and the love for the gospel and for souls. While at Baylor, he published a number of books, including The Participle in the Book of Acts, which was his doctoral dissertation, The Function of Teaching in Christianity, New Testament History and Literature, and a collection of sermons entitled Citizens of Two Worlds and Other Sermons. He mentioned in this book that he produced this with the hope that young preachers, especially, might be helped in the production of textual and expository sermons. A good example there as well. He was in a flourishing ministry here at Southwestern, but in 1919, Howard College, now Samford, in Alabama, came calling, and he accepted the presidency at this school. He was acclaimed at that time as, quote, one of the greatest scholars in the South. In his 2 years there, he paid off large debt, raised money for endowment, which sometimes goes right over the heads of many of us, but is very important, the work of a university, as anyone in administration knows. The Standard History of Samford also notes, quote, Dr. Williams, early in his administration, brought to Howard a new awareness of the spirit of Christian religion. In his inaugural address at Howard, Williams gave his argument for the need for the continuing of Christian higher education in the rapidly changing post-World War I world. And what he says in this address is very fitting for our task here at Union. In fact, foreshadows it in a number of ways. I'll give you a few quotes from it. In one place, he writes this, or stated this, the only way we can realize the fine definition of education given by the author of the ancient Democritus, education makes the body hard, the heart soft, and the head right, is to build and maintain a superb system of thoroughly equipped Christian colleges. In no other way can the world be held in poise in its philosophical and theological thinking. Bishop Welsh has aptly said, education without religion is simply veneering rotten wood. The intellectual, aesthetic, and artistic polish given to the individual without religion and its practical ideas for the proper use of culture is merely educational veneering. Culture received in a Christian college or from a Christian teacher with a personal conviction, culture for Christ's sake and for humanity's sake, is a root full of intellectual, social, moral, and religious sap capable of producing the beautiful branches of character, life, and service for the state, the church, and the kingdom. Later, in language foreshadowing our goals here at Union, Williams called for the highest standards of scholarship at the school, and then for this scholarship to be fully integrated with the gospel. He stated, if I am to study geology and astronomy, I prefer to have a teacher who knows not only the age and history of the rocks, the structure and magnitude of the stars, but who also knows the God of the rocks and the God of the stars, whose personal touch will lead me to think more of the God of the rocks and the God of the stars than of the rocks and stars of God. He was not in a day yet when we spoke of the rock stars of God. But this quote shows his value, his estimation of the integration of faith and learning, as well as, I think, his way with words. But his tenure at Howard was short, only 2 years, as he ran into opposition to his plan to move the school. His vision was to create, quote, one of the finest technological departments, including a first-class engineering school in the South. The faculty and trustees endorsed this plan, but according to the official Samford history, local alumni opposed the idea and successfully worked to force Williams out. Williams' resignation letter then was printed in the local paper. And the letter itself shows traces of his wit and of the bitter struggle. In the midst of a standard way of saying, I'm resigning my position, he said, quote, as a true sport, I take my hat off to the winners of the game, the Eastlake minority, thereby naming those who were responsible. He also stated, I want also to express my soulful appreciation at the fine spirit displayed by all members of my faculty, with one or two exceptions. Even though it was unsuccessful, we do see here the visionary leadership of Williams. Many private colleges made important moves in the 50s and forward, including Union's move to this campus in 1975. But here, Williams, ahead of the curve, proposing such a move in the 20s. And in his resignation letter, he stated, I do not feel that my program for the greater Howard has utterly failed. It has been only temporarily suspended. the providence of God may raise up another to realize my ideal, if not as I conceived it, in some other form. And that's exactly what happened. The college never moved to the site that Williams had selected, but in 1953, 1 year after his death, Howard College did relocate for the same reasons that he had mentioned, and the college has then thrived there for many years since that time. When he left Howard, he was appointed chair of the New Testament interpretation at Mercer, and his wife's health had begun deteriorating, especially in their time in Birmingham. She was hospitalized the summer before moving to Mercer. In his letters, Dr. Williams comments on the fruitfulness of his teaching at Mercer, but also his loneliness when Mrs. Williams was hospitalized. And in January of 1925, Mrs. Williams died. Sometime the summer or fall of that year, Union University contacted Williams. Having lost his wife and endured much, it appears that he may have been wanting a change of location. Apparently, Dr. Pinnock, for whom this complex is named, contacted him. And Williams would have been quite a catch for Union at this time. There's one of his portraits as professor. And then here's the Cardinal and Cream announcing his coming. It's a big cover story. Scholar from Mercer added to faculty. In the following decade, Union's administration would begin to work hard to have more professors with PhDs. Here was one coming already with that and with many other accolades of service. From what I've been able to uncover, in 1925, Williams would have been one of just a handful, perhaps less than five, faculty members at Union with a PhD. So he would have been a significant gain. Williams' appointment was announced in November of 1925 in this article, and then he began his duties here in the winter term of 1926. When I began to notice this, I wondered, how did they get a hold of Williams? What was the draw? Apparently, the contact came through a young Union professor named Julius Manty. Manty had been a student of Williams while he was at Southwestern, and then while Williams was at Mercer, he taught PhD seminars at the University of Dubuque, and there he had Manty once again. So when Manty resigned to go to Northern Seminary, it appears that Manty put the university in contact with Williams in order to take his place. Manty would go on from here and publish, along with H.E. Dana of Southwestern Seminary, a manual grammar of the Greek New Testament, which would become the standard intermediate Greek grammar for several decades. And in the preface to that grammar, Dana Manty wrote this: "It is but just that we should acknowledge here our constant use of the unpublished grammar notes of Professor C.B. Williams, Union University, Jackson, Tennessee, who, while in the chair of Greek New Testament in the Southwestern Seminary, was the honored preceptor of both authors. Through Williams' influence on this grammar, which was then the standard one for decades, he exerted influence and helped to shape generations of Greek students, including myself. Dr. Williams seems to have made an immediate impression on the campus at Union. He shows up several times in the Cardinal and Cream in his very first year in 1926. At this time, the paper, which was weekly, ran a column each time called Chapel Echoes, where the student writers would pick one chapel address and comment on it and have quotes from it. In the first 2 months of his time here, his chapel message is picked up two times. Significant. By October, an article in the paper refers to him as, quote, one of our favorite lecturers. And Dr. Baggett, in his History of Union, notes that Williams was always a favorite of students as a chapel speaker. In January, his first month here, Williams preached on Romans 14 on the importance of influence. And the student writer quoted him in saying this: "Students are accustomed to saying that we are not in life now. This is false, for the greatest days of life are now being lived on the campus." It was interesting to me to find him making this point, which a number of us make in our classes to you as well. Real life does not begin later, it is now. In that same sermon, he made these points. Each person is a sinker or a lifter. Your influence either inspires to higher things in life or degrades. Students are capable of the higher influences, the result of beautiful thoughts and deeds. And Dr. Williams lived up to this influence, exerting positive influence on many. Many people don't realize that we here at Union do have a Charles Bray Williams Scholarship. It was founded in 1986 by Mr. Jesse T. Duck of Trenton, Tennessee, a 1934 graduate of Union. And in the official papers establishing the scholarship, he says that he established this fund, quote, in grateful recognition of the blessings of God and to honor the memory of a great professor at his alma mater, Dr. Charles Bray Williams. In a letter to the university earlier than this, Mr. Duck also wrote this: Dr. Williams was, I believe, the most outstanding scholar who served at Union during the years I attended Union. It was a privilege to have Dr. Williams give my high school commencement address and later to study the New Testament under him. He was a kindly, scholarly man, and I valued his leadership. Not long into his time at Union, the Great Depression struck. During this time, the faculty voted to take a 20% pay cut just to keep the university afloat. I'm not making application at that point. But apparently this didn't even help because the college hadn't actually been able to pay faculty for several months. But Williams, as a senior professor, led the way here, not only with that pay reduction, but also contributing back a significant portion of his salary simply to keep the university afloat. Many people were involved in the difficult time of keeping the doors open during those days. Those of us who study here and are employed here are then indebted to sacrificial service and giving of many people, including Dr. Williams. He is one reason under God why there is a Union University still here today. He also comments in his letters of the suffering of the people in town. He wrote once to his brother, "There's lots of suffering in Tennessee. We are having to do much charity work here in Jackson to help the very poor who are out of jobs and have nothing to live on." So there's an example again. This is no ivory tower academician, but one who is seeking to help those in need. While he was here in 1933, Williams was also serving as interim pastor at Friendship Baptist Church in Friendship, Tennessee, and he met a young school teacher named Edith Stallings. They were married the following year. And then the following year, Williams, who was then 66, had a daughter named Charlotte, who is the one who is here with us today. Then in 1937, Williams completed his labor of love, the work for which he is best known, his translation of the New Testament, which paid particular understanding or attention to the Greek verb tenses, which had been a key interest of his. He'd been working on this for over 20 years, he said, apparently after criticizing a standard translation in class, and a student then suggested he turn out a better one. So he set out to do just that. Williams made very clear that his goal in the translation was not a word-for-word translation, but a capturing of the idiom of the Greek New Testament. In this way, he is really articulating what we call now the dynamic equivalence approach to translation. So Williams is here again ahead of his time. This translation enjoyed wide appreciation and acceptance. Julius Manti, who I mentioned before, said that Williams' translation, considering all the factors, is the most accurate and illuminating translation in the English language. Or Warren Wiersbe, in his book, Which Bible Can You Trust?, said, "For accuracy in translation of the Greek verbs, the Williams translation stands head and shoulders above the others." Dr. Baldwin, just this week, mentioned to me how his father, a pastor, had appreciated and used the Williams translation. It's one example of many people who have benefited from this work. There he is at Union once more. And then, to pause here to note that the work of Williams was really the beginning of what we have as a heritage of contributing to English Bible translation here at Union. We have the Williams translation, and then in 1991, Union graduate Barclay Newman produced the contemporary English version, and then in more recent years, Dr. Gary Smith, with the translations mentioned there, and Dr. Guthrie working on these translations. Another good piece of our heritage. In 1939, Williams retired from Union and his pastorate at First Baptist Brewston, moved to Tampa. He continued to do some work there, having in one of his classes a young student named Billy Graham. And then in 1941, he moved on to North Carolina, back to his hometown, to Shiloh, to pastor Shiloh Baptist Church. And there in this pastorate, Miss Charlotte Sprawls, who was with us, commented on part of his approach to pastoral ministry, stating that Dr. Williams believes strongly in a pastor's knowing personally every member in his church, and he had a very active plan of visitation of every family in their home every few weeks. In his 70s, pastoring a 700-member church, Williams made a point to know each member and to visit each family on a regular basis. Many people know that Richard Baxter suggested this and then say that nobody's ever lived up to it, but it's not true, as a number of historical examples would point out. But here's an example in the 20th century in Southern Baptist life of this approach to pastoral ministry. In 1946, at age 77, he retired again, moved to Florida, and then even as his health began to fail, he was working on his commentary on the Pauline Epistles, which was then published posthumously. In 1952, he passed away. And the Sunday after his death, his home pastor wrote this tribute in the church bulletin. Last Sunday, our beloved Dr. Charles B. Williams breathed his last in the Bartow Hospital and took his flight to realms of glory to be with Jesus. We greatly miss him. He was a world-famous scholar of the Greek New Testament, a wonderful teacher, a prince of preachers, a gracious friend, a saint indeed, and a father and husband beloved. His example in this church will be a blessing and challenge to be faithful unto death. At the age of 83, he never missed a service until he became too ill to attend. God hallow his memory. His reward in heaven will be something great. His was a life well lived. And as I looked through his life and was challenged on many places, I really thought of the way to summarize some of the lessons he would give to us can appropriately be the four core values of union. One of them being excellence driven. We noticed his hard work, even as a boy, to learn Latin. His holding of two jobs and the writing projects that he was doing. His hard work to make sure and get the doctoral work done. We saw him as future directed with a visionary leadership at Howard College and the forerunner of dynamic equivalence translations. We saw him as people focused with the testimony of students that he cared for. His pastoral labors in many ways in caring for the poor. And I haven't mentioned quite as much yet that from his works, it is a clear line of Christ-centeredness. As I've read through his works, he clearly takes on the errors of his day and counters them. When people wanted to argue that Christianity was simply a mixture of religious ideas, he argues clearly for the uniqueness of Christ. Some wanted to say that the moral teachings of Jesus were the most important, but he argued in his sermon, Christianity's Chief Attraction, that it is not Jesus' moral teaching or the fatherhood of God, but the cross of Christ, which is the chief attraction of Christianity. At the same time, though, he rejected the harshness and narrowness of others who came in this time. We find in Williams, in his writings, a warm attachment to Christ and a desire to point others to him. In the preface to his New Testament translation, he wrote, "May the face of Christ, who is the theme of this book and the light of the world, shine into the heart and upon the life of everyone who reads it." And in his book on New Testament Christology, published while he was at Union, he stated his goal in writing was that all who read or study this treatise may be reassured in their faith in the historical Jesus, who is the Son of God and the Savior of men. Union University has a goodly heritage. Let us preserve and perpetuate it. We give thanks to God for the life of Charles Williams. May we too live and die so fully given to the glory of Christ, the edification of his church, and the salvation of souls.